from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to the Two Johnnies, it's Wednesday the 14th of September and this is Game On. Coming up on the show, Damien Lawler and Nadine Doherty will bring us up to date on the managerial merry-go-round. Alan Cawley and Paul Curry will join us to chat about the Champions League and we'll preview the URC with Neil Tracy. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Welcome along to the show on this Wednesday evening. I'm delighted to say that Nadine Doherty is with me in studio. We are going to talk Gaelic games. We're in the off season, Nadine. How are you passing the time?
Very busy. We're back to school. Had a few lovely weeks off, but it has been very busy getting back. Delighted to be back in off season, which is great. But yeah, all good. And you?
How are you getting your GA fix?
Well, I'm going off to Nafina tonight over to DCU. Nafina ladies are playing Thomas Davis in the Dublin Club semi-final and Crokes are playing Sylvester's in the other semi-final. So for the first time in, I'd say, a good 12 years, Fox Cab aren't in a knockout,
right,
which is really interesting.
Very good. What time's that on?
That's at 8, yeah. So anybody over Glasnevin, Drumcondra direction, get up to DCU to support the girls.
The place to be for sure. Well, Damien Lawler joins us now on the line. Damien, how are you? Off training, I bet you, or on your way training?
Oh, gee. I said, how did you know that?
The story of your life.
Yeah, I've just about two collections to do today, Marie. So basically, going out to the GAA field now and then straight up to the soccer pitch then and back down for ladies football. So it's yeah, you were asking Nadine about getting the GAA fix. I just need a GAA anti-fix.
Yeah, it's what everybody's at now in the evenings, isn't it? It's just activity after activity after activity. But you were getting your GAA fix, going to Mayo to interview Kevin McStay.
Yeah, up there last night. I suppose I'm pulling here to Nace GEA, watching all the kids go by and all the parents, and you know, everybody's looking forward to going in training. It was very much like that last night at Castlebar, Marie. A new dawn for Mayo GEA. Kevin was there with Damien Mulligan and Stephen Rochford, two of his coaches and selectors. He unveiled 95% of his backroom team last night, including Evan Regan as nutritionist and Niamh Fitzpatrick as sports psychologist. A very clinical medical team, and he's just over the moon, to be honest with you. The body language was not looking too far ahead, but have a 4-year term, but really trying to get the walking wounded back, like Ryan O'Donoghue, Tommy Conroy. Bit of a scare about Killian O'Connor at the moment, Marie. He took a knock in the club championship match last weekend. Be concerned about that, but just to get everybody back. His backroom team is stellar. It's very, very impressive. I think the one thing he was trying to get across last night really was that it is a stellar backroom team. He worked very hard to get them. They had to work very hard to get the job. They had a two-hour interview. Kevin is of an army background and said it was as tough as a grilling as he ever got. But they're just keen to get an unmerciful pre-season behind them, get everybody kind of in unison together and go from there. So I asked him questions about like style of play, about maybe hanging on to the more experienced players. He was non-committal. He wouldn't get specific about stuff. We all know, like, they've lost 11 All-Ireland since 89. So we all know that winning an All-Ireland is the goal here. But he wouldn't be drawn on that. He was just saying, look, SPD League, Connacht Championship, and you're into the round robin straight away. The Euro creep up on him very quickly. But very, very positive. We got a good reaction. Locally, they would feel that, you know, the media kind of didn't have much interaction with the team over the last couple of years. Certainly, I think Kevin McStay wants to maybe work on that. And he was full of praise for what James Horan did in transitioning young lads. So there's no excuses, Marie. They're ready to go. The big backroom team. They have a good panel of players. And the landscape is probably not as it was when Dublin were dominant.
Damien, you've been to so many of these now, and I think particularly Mayo, we've seen managers come along and unveil stellar backroom teams and, you know, so excited about the job at hand and like having players and getting close and all the rest. And things don't work out then, or they don't reach what they're trying to achieve, which is get the Sam Maguire. What's different about Kevin McStay?
Okay, so like the unusual thing here is he looks so many times for the job. Like, he looked for the job on a number of occasions. And he was never successful. He's 60 now, Marie, and he didn't. I think he felt his time had passed. Like, we have a piece going out now on the 6-1 News in a few minutes, and he just kind of said that in his own mind, he felt his time had passed. He got pretty emotional then when he recounted the night that he actually got the job, himself and his family, and how they reacted to that news. What's different? He suddenly then, from not getting the job on a number of occasions, they've handed him a four-year term. I would say what's different about that is we're all around long enough to know, except yourself, Nadine, that a four-year term doesn't mean a whole lot if results go wrong pretty quickly. I would feel that there is no massively dominant team on the circuit at the minute. You might say to me, Kerry are going to be there for the next couple of years. You wouldn't put everything on that. It's quite possible. Dublin are nowhere near as dominant as they were. We don't know what Tyrone are going to come back with. You know, can Galway maintain what they have and build on that next year? It's going to be a massive challenge for them as well. So I think what one thing he's got going for him is they have a chance. You know, I mean, the landscape is not... A lot of those finals, a lot of those 11 finals they lost, they weren't expected to win a lot of those finals. Now, there was probably two or three that they were. But I'm just making the point that you get those injured lads back, you change the style of attack. That's the first thing that needs to be done. I think if he had his way, he'd put O'Shea at 14. It'd be interesting to see what his backroom team feel about that. But he knows himself, maybe, the Mayo attack needs examination. He didn't comment on that last night, but I think he knows himself. And a few factors. He's got a steady backroom team with him. They've all managed themselves. They've all achieved a lot in the game. They're all more experienced now than ever before. He has time to devote to this. It's his full focus for the next 4 years. There are no ultra-dominant teams right there at the minute. And I suppose, ultimately, the sports psychology aspect is going to be massive. A lot of these players are burnt, they're hurt. Neve Fitzpatrick is top, top class. She's worked with Irish Olympians, Olympic teams. She helped Griffin back in 96 with Wexford. She knows what it takes to get over the line. She's one of the best in the business. So I can't say there's too much more different about Max Day than this, but they are the things that maybe he has going in his favour now going forward.
And Damien, you just, you know, spoke there that Kevin thought that his time had passed maybe a few years ago. And yeah, we focused on the management team there. So looking at the panel, are there any players who maybe might be feeling that their time has passed? Is there going to be a shake-up? Are there going to be players gone who have been there for a while? What are your thoughts?
I get the feeling, Nadine, that he'll do all he can to stick with what he has and maybe try and use the club championship to get another three or four players out of it. Like, for example, he's been talking about putting in Aidan O'Shea as a target man for the last couple of years. I've been listening to him on podcasts and stuff like that. The likes of Lee Keegan, he certainly doesn't have to. He doesn't have to look anywhere. You know, his form hasn't dipped one bit. The likes of Brendan Harrison coming back from injury, you know, like these guys. I suppose the one point he did make, Nadine, is Ryan O'Donoghue, Tommy Conroy. Like, Ryan is not back playing with his club even yet. Tommy Conroy, Killian O'Connor, and Brendan Harrison, and there's three or four more on the extended panel who were injured. They're all going to need special treatment coming back. He made the point to me on a number of occasions, he wants a great pre-season. You know yourself what a great pre-season means. It means emptying the tank, getting people up to unbelievable conditioning levels, which they're not far off of anyway, and getting people ready to go at once. But there's no way you can bring back those few names I've mentioned and trust them straight in. So I don't think many people are going to step away. I don't think many people will want to step away, but they're going to have to look after those injuries very, very carefully. And the attritional running game that they play to Nadine, that might need to be tweaked a bit. I mean, if you have Aidan O'Shea, the gas thing is, when they put O'Shea in at number 14 in recent seasons, they haven't got the ball into him quick enough.
No.
Or if they have, he's been isolated up front. They've persisted with the running game when they have put him in, and it hasn't really made much sense to me. If you put Aidan O'Shea in 14, you get the two corners working off of him. And I think that's how you get. But you must get the ball in directly to him and get it in at a diagonal, get it in at an angle. Otherwise, it's pointless putting him in. So I think those are the challenges that will be facing the management team as they go ahead. My gut feeling is they won't lose too many. I think if you wanted to go, you would have gone while the search for a manager was on. I think you would have maybe nailed your colours to the mast on that one.
So, Damien, like, these players are obviously amateur players and you only have them for a certain amount of time a week because they have their work and their college commitments. there's an awful lot of people in that backroom team who have coaching backgrounds and have done their own thing at a management level as well. Do you think it's going to be difficult for everybody to almost get their pound of flesh or to do their bit when there are so many of them and so little contact hours as well?
Well, I know from any backroom team I've been involved with, you want to have an involvement, you want impact.
Mm-hmm.
Most coaches want time on the field. There's no point in saying otherwise. You want to make an imprint. You want to walk out that door and make sure the players don't think that you're a bluffer. And that's the bottom line. None of these guys are bluffers, obviously. But I think McStay is very thoughtful on this. It's a great point you raise. And I think the way he's divvied out his backroom team, I'm actually looking for the file here in front of me, Marie, and I try and call it up as I can. Stephen Rochford is the assistant manager and will be working very much as a coach alongside him. I think Lee McHale is going to be a selector and a coach with a liaison for the county under 20. Damien Mulligan is a bright new spark coming along, very, very highly rated at club level, and he'd be kind of on the ground for the club liaison going through. Donny Buckley, he's a general coach mm-hmm. and a selector, and I think you're right, like a training session only lasts so long. So whether they do it in blocks, whether they decide to focus on defence, whether they decide to focus on transition, whether they decide to focus on maybe more direct play, whether they decide to focus on possession, I would have to imagine that all these coaches are going to have to get a block of coaching mm-hmm. themselves just to be satisfied with their own performance. He's a fairly big backroom team. Sean Moffat is over the medical side of things. Dr. Lisa Cunningham is helping out there. Conor Finn is involved in athletic performance. Niamh Fitzpatrick is the sports psychologist. Gary Coughlin is the physiotherapist. Evan Regan is the nutritionist. Liam Horan is back in communications, Marie. And Sean Finnegan is over logistics. Sean Finnegan has been a lifelong friend of McStay's. I think they'll watch each other's back. On paper, Kevin McStay is saying the main thing is he's made the point that they're all in cohesion. Trying to get Stephen Rochford on board was probably an initial task. And once he got Stephen on board, everything else came into play pretty quickly. The one thing there, I will say from what I think I know on the out, there's no real egos there. Mm-hmm. Stephen Rochford's been coaching in Donegal. I think he'd be quite happy to play along and do what's asked of him. Lee McHale is Kevin's brother-in-law as well. They go back years together. So I think they'll be okay. I think they'll be tight enough. And Donny Buckley will want his say on the coaching field. There's no point in saying otherwise. But Kevin McStay is a serious man, and he'll have built that into his plans too, I would imagine.
Yeah, no better man. He'd be well able. Damien Lawler, thank you so much. You can head off now and enjoy the training, and we'll chat to you soon.
That's good stuff, Marie. Okay, look after yourself, Marie and Nadine. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Nadine, in complete contrast to that, so you have down in Mayo, you have Kevin McStay talking about the pre-season that he wants. He's got all these different people in place for the roles that need to be done. He's going to matches, he's looking at players, he's meeting people, he's plans in place. He has a block of months that he knows that's coming up, and I'm sure he's established what he needs to work on during that time. While up in Donegal,
tumbleweed,
there's nobody, they have no manager, and there doesn't seem to be even any suggestion of somebody coming in. What's going on there? As a Donegal woman.
Well, it's very disappointing as a Donegal woman, and especially the time of the year, Marie, as you say. I mean, I know it's September, but pre-season is on for the majority of county teams in terms of planning. The nominations closed mid-August, and there were two names really being thrown around then. Obviously, there was Malachy O'Rourke, and there was Sean Paul Barrett, who in fact is Amber's dad, Amber, who plays soccer with Ireland. Yeah. So Sean Paul would have been involved with the under-20s and the minors and so on. So those two names were heavily mentioned. And then there's, I suppose at Donegal, there's a few disadvantages, Marie. I mean, there has been that tradition of a manager from Donegal. Mm-hmm. You've had McInniff twice, Declan Bonner twice, John Joe Doherty, Jim, obviously. And then you've had Rory Gallagher and Mickey Moore, an external, and that's been it in my time anyway. And then you're looking, the commitment levels, as Damien was talking about there. And I heard somebody during the week saying the only people who be getting involved in management are either people who are retired or or teachers.
I was trying to think when he mentioned Kevin McStay, and obviously he's retired now, and I was there thinking of Colm O'Rourke and he's retired, and I was thinking then what does Oisín McConville, I was going through my head all the different, I think he works in DKIT, all the different appointments over the last while, and was trying to figure out what they do, and a lot of them, as you said, are either retired or teachers.
There's obviously a mindset out there that teachers are retired before they retire. We are not. So look, there's time, obviously. And then, look, with Donegal, geographically, we're at a massive disadvantage, Marie. And it's always been like that for players and attracting players who are even at college. Commitment levels, high expectations from Donegal fans, from a panel who you look at really over the last 10 years. And it's 10 years since we won that All-Ireland. There's been rebuilding, you know. I don't know if the talent pool is there. And then for me, and this is the biggest thing, there's a massive Jim McGuinness hangover in terms of how Donegal play football. Mm-hmm. And there's that super defensive style that just hasn't worked. But the problem is that has been played at club level in Donegal for the last 10 years. So you have young players in their mid-20s. They've been drilled in that style of football since they were under 12 or under 14. So if you're a manager looking in from the outside, you're thinking, this is going to take years.
A revolution,
absolutely.
An
evolution. Yeah, well, Jim was the revolution. Now we need an evolution. So, you know, there's all those factors. You look at players, Michael Murphy is still top of his game. I was reading a few club reports there this evening. You know, he basically single-handed has Glenn Swilly in a quarter-final. He's outstanding. But I just feel, and, you know, it's my own opinion, there aren't enough lads stepping up to his level. You know, I'd look at Paddy McBurty there, who was, you know, he was going to be our David Clifford or our Conn O'Callaghan. And, you know, Paddy has been brilliant in a few games in Ulster. But when it comes to the crunch, we don't have that talisman outside of Michael Murphy. So you'd have managers looking at that. And I don't think money is an issue, you know, because you look at clubs even around the country. And I was talking to a guy who's managing a club at the minute, and he would have managed inter-county teams. And he said it's nearly like, you know, a second income at times. So there's that. The money isn't a thing. But a massive thing, if you talk to anybody from Donegal about Declan Bonner and why Declan stepped away, there's massive social media abuse apparently in Donegal, and it goes with those expectations. And Declan came out himself and spoke about how his children, his daughter as young as 18, got massive abuse for the last year, really. I think, you know, when things weren't going Declan's way and people wanted a change, they were being abused on social media, and apparently that is a huge factor in attracting potential managers. So look, Malachy O'Rourke has distanced himself. Sean Paul Barrett could be the man to go to. You have Rory Kavanagh, who is doing fantastic work with St Junans. But, you know, Rory has a young family. He's only in his second or third year with Junans. There's Martin Regan of Glenties. A lot of names have been mentioned, but it's really difficult to see who is going to take them, Marie, and that's the truth. My own choice out of them all would have been Malachy O'Rourke. I like the way he had Monaghan moving, you know, and he got Monaghan moving when they were an average enough team. You know, he got a huge amount out of them, so I feel he could be the kind of guy who could take Donegal. Look, we've been in 10 out of 12 Ulster finals, but I mean, nobody, Ulster's competitive, but it's not about Ulster. It's not about the province anymore. It's about an All-Ireland, and I do think Donegal are a long way off. And I don't think Maxie was mentioned as well, you know, and this is me being biased for the ladies, but I think Maxie's going to stay with the ladies team. If he was going to move, I think he would have said it by now. And Martin McHugh has distanced himself, so I don't know where any more names are going to come from. That's not giving you a short answer. You know, it is worrying. Yeah, it's really worrying.
There's a lot of factors there, and I totally understand why people wouldn't want to do it, and I'm well aware of the commitment that it takes, and you know, the abuse and everything that comes with it as well. But Damien made the point though too that it is wide open, you know what I mean? Like, we're sitting here, you know, we were to start a conversation about who's going to be lifting the Sam Maguire next year, like, it's hard to know. So
absolutely,
you could throw Donegal into the mix 100%. If they got their act together.
And in fairness to the lads, they have, and Declan Bonner has, and it's just been, I feel with Donegal in the last years, when they've been favourites, they've underperformed. It's when they go in as underdogs, you know, you get the best out of them. But I mean, if we were sitting here 3 or 4 years ago, we were talking about splitting Dublin in north and south, and Dublin were going to dominate for 10 years. So it just shows how the landscape can change in such a short space of time. And there is massive potential in Donegal. There's a huge amount, but it's a big task, definitely. I just hope they find the right person. And look, there's a committee in place there, and I'm sure they are scouring high and low. And listen, there could be loads of ongoing conversations going on that we don't know about, because there has been a bit of a policy there because of the social media aspect of it, that it has been kept hush hush. So hopefully,
and that's fair, because if
that started on someone before they'd even got the job, they might run an absolute mile. And just before we finish up, Nadine, I was watching a little bit of the women's AFL highlights on Monday night on TG Carr, and I saw Vicky Wall score her first goal.
Yes, I didn't see it because, as I've said before, I don't really like watching the game, but I do keep up with it on their social media. It's really good, and Vicky got her first goal, and Eric O'Shea apparently is playing really, really well for the club. Cora's doing what Cora does. I think she's on 7 or 8 goals at the minute, and Orlo Dwyer's team are just flying. Right, they seem to really be as expected, and I think Orla's in high demand over there every off season in terms
she's a big player, big name, and they want her. Okay, well, Nadine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Before we head for a break, Celtic are leading Shakhtar Donetsk 1-0. That game is on in Poland, and it was an OG. We're going to take a very quick break now, but stay with us. Alan Cawley is waiting patiently outside to come in and join us.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to the show. Alan Cawley is with me in studio. Paul Corey joins me on the line. And what a difference a few minutes makes, because Shakhtar Donetsk have equalised. Alan Cawley was watching a little bit of it. And Alan, they look like they are the ones that are in control now.
Yeah, they've just scored. Mudrick, who we've actually seen with Ukraine there in a couple of the games against the Irish team recently, and he's a very dangerous player, electric on the wing where he loves to cut inside, but he's after scoring. And it was disappointing from Celtic's point of view, because they made a great start to the game, they dominated the early spells, got the goal in front, and they just switched off for a split second, and Mudrick has punished them, and as you say, it's given them momentum in the game now, and they're the ones in the ascendancy. So hopefully for a big second half for Celtic, but they'll be disappointed with the goal they've conceded.
Yeah, big games on at the moment. Last night as well, we might as well start with Liverpool, Paul, and their victory over Ajax. And I guess, look, there was some negatives there, but there was some positives as well, and Mo Salah looking like he's back on track is one worth taking away from it.
Yeah, absolutely, Marie. I mean, that's probably where you'd start the conversation is probably with Salah. And you know, much has been made of Mane going out the door, but maybe the eyes have been off Salah, but they certainly need to get him back and scoring and contributing in that final third. And I thought he took his goal really well last night. I do think, you know, looking at the three that played last night, that for me seems to be their strongest at this moment in time. I think Salah looks much more comfortable playing with Jota through the middle. I think Jota brings an energy and creates spaces for Salah in that position. So to see him back in the score sheet, I'm sure Jurgen Klopp will be absolutely delighted. But maybe another one then to look at is Thiago. I mean, Liverpool look such a much better team with Thiago in the middle of the pitch. Not only the creativity and his ability to kind of link back to front, but even the energy that he had in his game last night was superb. And I know the stats are very much weighted in favour of Liverpool, that they collect way more points than Thiago's fit, but between himself and Salah's goal, like the contributions that they made last night were very noticeable. And then finally Matip at the back, like just so much more solid, looks like it. That seems to be their best partnership with himself and Van Dijk. And for Liverpool, no league game now until October 1. It's about getting those players rested, keeping them fit, and hoping that they can maybe bring them back to some of the form that they had over the last 12, 24 months.
Yeah, it's like there was, as you outlined there, lots of positives. But, Alan, at the same time, there was a few worrying moments and a few kind of hands over the eyes. I think when Trent goes anywhere near the ball now, it's a worry. And even Van Dijk, you know, you're so used to seeing him been composed in ways on the field and off the field as well. But like he's been making mistakes. He doesn't look like himself. He's not as solid as he seems. And then off the field, you know, he's taking swipes at former players for trying to bring them down, and that doesn't seem like him, not that I know him.
Yeah, I was just about to say that, Marie. Even off the pitch, that's the one thing that struck me, was that he was having a dig back, obviously, at the criticism that they've received. And look, when you're as good as he is, and when you're playing a team as good as Liverpool have been over the last 3 or 4 years, if you drop a load of standards that they've set, and I know it's very hard to maintain those incredible standards that they've reached over the last 3 or 4 years, but when you drop below them, and especially to the extent that they've dropped below them, you are going to get criticised, no matter how good you are. And his level has dropped. But I don't think it's dropped to the level where obviously you'd have concerns about him. He's still a brilliant player. I think there's probably more of a problem in the sense that who partners him, and when it's Matip or whether it's Gomez, like we saw last week at the nightmare he had against Napoli. I think that maybe takes away then from Van Dijk. You need a set partnership no matter what club you're playing for, and I think that's what we saw last year when Matip played every week with him, and they had that set partnership. They were absolutely outstanding, and Matip was very good last night, and I think he just gives a little bit more protection on that side to Trent as well. that's where they got exploited massively against Napoli. And I don't want to pin it all on Trent because everybody's focusing on him, and I'm glad you brought up Salah, but he gives no protection whatsoever to Trent. When you think of how good Liverpool were with Mane and Robertson last year, and Mane was such a team player, and I know you're focusing on the fact that Salah scored the goal and it is a positive, but this might sound a silly thing to say, but if Salah doesn't score a goal, he offers very little else, to be honest with you, Marie. And you kind of can see that in terms of when we used to see Mane, and that's why he was so pivotal and so good, that even if he didn't score a goal, he was still giving so much to the team and so much energy and so much protection on that left hand side with Robertson as well, and they had a brilliant partnership. I don't really see that partnership with Trent and Salah. They obviously love it when they're going forward, but defensively both of them are a liability in my eyes down that side. So I know all the focus on Trent, and I agree with that, because defensively he's so poor, but he's brilliant going forward. But I think you have to cut him a bit of slack as well, in the sense that so many games you watch, there's 2v1 situations all the time, and there's overloads against them, and I think that's an area that they need to protect as well, especially when you play Harvey Elliott, who's an outstanding player on that right hand side as well, but again he's all about going forward and being creative and stuff, and he gives you very little, whereas maybe a Henderson in that right hand side of a tree gives you more protection to help Trent as well.
So we need a bit of balance, Alan, as well.
Bit of balance, yeah. Bit of balance.
Before we move on to tonight's games, Paul, just a quick look at some more of last night's results. And a disappointing night for Spurs, really, when you consider that it's Sporting, a team that you would think they should beat.
Yeah, Spurs being a bit Spursy last night, Marie, you know. Yeah, it really was poor last night. And it's kind of, been on the cards, I feel, for the last couple of weeks, Much has been made about Conte and kind of grafting results and being able to maybe pull 3 points out of the bag where Spurs haven't done previously. But at some point, you do want to see the performance levels kind of go with the 3 points. And that hasn't been there for the last number of weeks, even thinking back to the Nottingham Forest game. Forest, by and large, controlled the majority of that game, just poor in both boxes, and Spurs capitalised. And that will only get you out of jail for so long. And I thought they were just really open, particularly in that last 15 minutes where they probably should have just shut up shop, sat in their shape and taken the point and gotten back out of, or getting out of there and back to London. But they were so open, Marie. Even just before the goal, there was one where Lloris has pulled off an incredible save just to touch it around the post. And you think, okay, we've rolled our luck there. But then again, ball comes in, really poor marking. Great delivery, but really poor marking. And they cough up a goal. And I don't know, it'd be interesting to hear what Alan thinks, but that back three does absolutely nothing for me, and I don't think Spurs are going to challenge on any fronts with a back three of Ben Davies, Romero and Eric Dier. That's just not enough protection. I think Lloris is always capable of coughing up a mistake, and then you don't really get a huge amount of protection from Bentancur and Højbjerg. So as a whole, there's still a lot of work to be done there. Harry Kane looked off, his son has been off for the last couple of weeks as well, so a lot of work to be done. But with Conte in charge, you would imagine he'd be able to get a bit more of a kick out of those players. But even looking at the players that they brought in, Basuma's hardly kicked the ball since he's gone into Tottenham. Same with Longley, I know he's nursing a bit of a knock, but the strength and depth isn't really there when you go beyond those substitutes. So it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks now and see how they bounce back from that result last night.
That's a good point about the players that he's brought in, because I thought initially the narrative around the team was that he was being loyal to the lads that he was there with last year, but obviously he strengthened in terms of the squad, and maybe after the few games you'd start to see them being integrated more into the team, but that hasn't happened at all. I was sure last night, even when I checked the team sheet, that Matt Doherty was going to get a run maybe last night. He hasn't featured at all, and obviously we're coming up to the games in the next couple of weeks, hasn't kicked the ball, Marie, and it's been very much the same 11-12 that he's used. He's brought on obviously Richarlison in the games, he's featured a bit, the new signing, but to me, I'm surprised. I thought Basuma would have featured as well, he's very good. I do like Romero, but to me it's a strange one with Eric Dier, because I've always been a critic of Eric Dier, yet no matter what manager Spurs have had in the last kind of couple of seasons, they've always picked him and played him, whether it be Mourinho, obviously Nuno, now even Conte as well, and he did do quite well towards the end of last season, but I still wouldn't be gone on him in terms of the bigger picture, especially if you're trying to top a Liverpool and the likes of Man City as well. But I think for Spurs this year, a run in the Champions League, maybe, I know it was a disappointing result, I think it's been a decent start, to be fair to them. They're in that top four. I don't think they're going to win the league. I don't think anyone expected them to. But I think with this, the players that he's brought in at the start of the year, if they get the top four and maintain that place and try and build on it again next year, I think that's what they're probably hoping for.
Okay, well, let's move on to tonight. So Chelsea are
going to play in the Champions League against Salzburg this evening. It is Graham Potter's first charge or time in charge of them for a Champions League game, and everybody is talking about their owner Todd Bowley, and I expect that this is going to be quite a common theme over the next few months. So Bowley was talking at a conference in New York, and he came up with all these suggestions for trying to make the Premier League more like American sports, because he obviously thinks American sports is way better than English football. And one of the things was that he would have an all-stars, or there should be an all-stars, and the bottom four teams should play off against each other and all this sort of stuff. But the all-stars suggestion has really, I think, irked people. Gary Neville has called him out on Twitter. Well, he's called American Investment out on Twitter. He said it is a danger to the fabric of the game. He hit out at the suggestions of Bowley to try and improve it. He seems really, really worried about it and said that it needs to be protected from US investment. Jurgen Klopp was asked about the All-Stars as well today in his press conference, and this is what he had to say.
Oh, great. When he finds a date for that, he can call me. when he wants to call us, and during, he forgets that in the big sports in America, these players have four-month breaks, so they're quite happy that they can do a little bit of sport in these breaks. It's completely different in football. Yeah, what can I say? Does he want to bring Harlem Globetrotters as well and let them play against a football team? I'm surprised by the question, so please don't judge my answers too much. But maybe you can explain it to me at one point and find a proper date. And then, yeah, not sure people want to see that, but imagine that. United players, Liverpool players, Everton players, all together in one team. It's not the national team. It's just a northwest and northwest and northeast together.
South.
North south. Yeah, okay, north against south, it means northeast and Newcastle. Well, interesting game. And all the London guys together, Arsenal, Tottenham, great. Did he really say it? Interesting.
Klopp actually makes it sound like something that that'd be worth watching, Paul.
Yeah, it's hard to know where to begin with that one, Marie. Like, I don't know. Like, Todd Bowley obviously feels now that he's got a bit of a voice and a bit of a say within the English game, and it would certainly worry as a Chelsea fan, because he's in acting now as sporting director at this moment in time. When he comes out with statements like that, it just shows how, I guess, unattached he is to the footballing world and the environment and everything that goes around us. Like, I don't know. I don't even know what more to say on it. It's just ridiculous. And we probably just need to keep the lips sealed for the next couple of weeks and just focus on matters at Chelsea.
I hate this stuff, Marie. I absolutely hate it. This fella's not involved in football in the Premier League a wet week, and he's coming out with the absolute nonsense and this stuff, like, in terms of Gary Neville is right about the fabric of the game. They have to realise what they're investing in here. And English football has been the way it is for the last 100 years, 150 years, whatever the case may be, and most football has been like that in each country. And for these to be coming in, and fair enough if it works across the pond or whatever way they work it, but it's totally different in terms of their structure to what's going on in the English game. So sometimes these owners as well, and I know, look, they're putting their money in, egomaniacs, fame hungry, I don't know what it is, they love to be kind of centre of attention.
And they think they're really relevant and that their views are really important.
I hate it. I absolutely hate it, Marie. I heard this stuff today and honestly I was cringing at it. But as Paul says, maybe he feels as though now he has a right because he is putting the money in, but it's dangerous in terms of where the game is going if these are the type of people that's investing in football. And you're talking there, I suppose, in the intro about maybe he was making these suggestions as to how you can improve the game. How much more can you improve the Premier League? That's, like, it's the biggest league in the world in terms of the money. There's never been more involved in it as well. The standard, the best managers are there, the best players. Like, it's absolute nonsense, this stuff.
Yeah, sorry. It really is. Good reaction as well. Lots of people agreeing with you. What planet is he on? People want to know. I guess when you have a lot of money and now you're a football club owner, generally people listen to what you have to say. So I'd say he's gone through a life of people telling him whatever he says is really interesting.
Yeah, and on that as well, Marie, a little worry, a little side kind of step to that would be Graham Potter, who I have so much time for and so much respect, and he's been absolutely brilliant and he carries himself so well and he's so dignified. He's going into a club now where I'm already dreading seeing this fella. And he, as I said, he's not in the place of wet week. And I'd be very concerned about what Graham Potter is letting himself in for as well, because sometimes the grass isn't always greener. And you move from a club like Brighton, you think it's a brilliant opportunity. And obviously it is, in terms of the size of Chelsea compared to Brighton. But if this is the type of stuff that the owner's coming out with after 2 weeks,
and publicly Paul, coming out with that as well,
and Paul said he's acting as a sporting director and all, I think they're probably, their views are way off in terms of what they're thinking, both of them.
Yeah, okay, well, they are in action tonight against Salzburg. There's actually some really good games on, but Paul, for me, the one that I'm most looking forward to is Man City and Dortmund, two teams that you would hope will go out and play good attacking football.
Yeah, and that typically tends to be the case, particularly when you think of Manchester City and the way they go about their business. It was actually, they met in the Champions League last year, I think it was, and City went through 4-2 on aggregate. And you would expect that there'd be a number of goals there tonight. But, I mean, it's hard to look beyond City in any fixture that they go into at the moment. And it's hard to look beyond Erling Haaland being on the score sheet against his former club. Dortmund probably aren't hitting the same sort of heights that they have done over the last number of years. And, of course, losing somebody like Haaland there to their team is going to take a long time to replace. But Man City, I mean, the options that they have all across the pitch, the way that they're playing at this moment in time, they just look as if any game they go into, they're going to dominate the ball, they're going to create chances, and Haaland's going to score. So it's going to be an interesting watch. You would imagine that both teams will qualify out of that group. The only other teams are Copenhagen and Seville, so they can probably play with a bit more freedom tonight, and hopefully that lends itself to a good watch. But I just think, like, with Guardiola, irrespective of what 11 he goes out with at this moment in time, there's so much strength, there's so much depth, there's so much creativity. And, you know, if you look at the games that they've played so far, it just all leads towards Man City wins and Erling Haaland goals.
No one's really got to grips with how to handle Haaland, for obvious reasons, just given his physicality and his physique and his ability and, you know, his speed. And I could go on, but I won't. It'll be interesting to see now what Dortmund do with him, because, like, they obviously know him so well.
I don't think that those centre-halves would be fancy playing against him either, Marie. I'd say they were delighted in the sense that they lost him, that they don't have to face him every day in training, but obviously devastated they don't have him in their team. But yeah, I don't think any centre-half would kind of relish the opportunity to play against Haaland, the form he's in at the moment. No matter who you are in the world, I think he'd cause all sorts of problems. And it's not just him. Fair enough, if you're kind of 1v1 against him in your centre half, it's what Man City bring all over the place as well. Like, you can only imagine playing against those players, how good they are in terms of their movement and the fluency, and you switch off for a second and you're punished. So I don't think too many would relish the chance of playing against them. And Paul's right, Man City, no matter who to put out on the pitch, the levels that they reach every week, to be fair, they're absolutely outstanding, and now with him as well. And I still go back to the conversation we had after the Charity Shield, where people were saying, oh, it's going to take him time to adjust. Marie, so you think he scored every week since?
I know, and I still haven't put him into my fantasy football team. It's gone too far now at this stage. Already we have a couple of games underway. Celtic and Shakhtar Donetsk is half time, and it is 1-1 there. Milan are beating Dinamo Zagreb 1-0 half time there. So Rangers, Napoli, Real Madrid, RB Leipzig, Juventus, Benfica, Man City and Dortmund, Maccabi, Haifa and PSG, Copenhagen and Sevilla, and Chelsea and Red Bull Salzburg all kicking off at 8 o'clock. And that rounds up our Champions League chat. Before we do finish up, guys, I wanted to have a chat with you about the Glenavon teenager Christopher Atherton. It's actually the most read story on the RTÉ Sports website now at the moment. People are so interested in this. So for anyone that hasn't seen or heard about Christopher Atherton, last night he's 13 years of age, and he made his debut for Glenavon, and he became the youngest player to play senior men's football in the UK. He broke the record set by Dubliner Eamon Collins. He lined out for Blackpool at 14 years, 323 days in 1980. So it's a long held record. Alan, thoughts on it?
Yeah, I'm unsure about this one, Marie, I have to say. Like, 13 years of age playing in a first team, in a first team environment, in around a dressing room with adults, grown adults, every day of the week or every evening or whatever that they're training. Yeah, like, if he's whatever level the young fella's at now, and I've never seen him play, and you mean to tell me if he's at that level now and they're putting him in the first team, will he not be at that level at 15 or 16? Like, what's the mad rush to throw a young fella 13 years of age into that environment? I really don't get it. And I know you said, we were chatting earlier a little bit about it, and you were saying, well, there was something similar with Evan Ferguson. The only comparison I can make to looking at the picture of that young lad, and as I said, I don't know the young lad, I haven't seen him played, but Evan Ferguson, the one thing he had in his favour was his physique, that he could merely, you could nearly look at him at 14 years of age playing with Bowes thinking, well, he might be able to handle himself a little bit, but I still didn't really, I wasn't mad on that one either, to be honest with you, Marie. And as I say, what's the mad rush to be throwing a young fella in at 13 years of age like that? I don't get it.
Okay, physiques, he doesn't look, I mean, we're only looking at pictures of him or little videos on Twitter, and he doesn't look as big as Evan Ferguson did. He did do well, like it was a 6-0 win. His manager was on Sky Sports News today. He said he got 13 touches of the ball. He didn't misplace any passes. He got an assist. He's been in and around the first team. He's done training. He's been watching him since he's 5 years of age. He thinks that he has the right mentality and physique and his ability to...
But of course he's going to say all that stuff, you know?
Yeah, of course he is. But like you're saying, Evan Ferguson, 14 years of age, when he played for Bohemians today... you know, there's headlines that he's not a million miles away from the Premier League.
Yeah, but he's 18 now, 19.
Yeah, but it didn't do him any harm is what I mean. So, look, I don't know if it's the right thing. I've absolutely no idea. I remember the Evan Ferguson thing, and I didn't even know that you could do that. Paul, what do you think?
Yeah, it doesn't sit right with me, to be honest with you, Marie. You know, I've coached that age group, and I think when you're at that age, I think it needs to be about the development of the player and the enjoyment of the game. And I think when you throw somebody into a game like that, You know, men's football and senior football is competitive. At times, you know, people's livelihoods are on the line here, and there's no way of avoiding that young kid being on the end of an absolute crunch and tackle or a two-footer that doesn't maybe necessarily end his career, but put him out for a long period of time. You look at his body, you look at where he's at physically and the way he's developed. He's a very slight, young 13-year-old,
he's
and I just
child.
Don't see any benefit.
I
don't see any benefit of throwing him in into a senior game like that. It stinks of a bit of a publicity stunt, to be honest with you, Maria. I don't know.
The manager didn't explain why, but besides saying that he felt he was ready. But, like, are they trying to sell him, Al? Is that what the...
Yeah. I don't know, like, Marie, in terms, as I said, I don't know the background to the manager, the club, or what they're thinking behind it. But for me, it's what's the mad rush? Even in terms of you come away from the football aspect of it as well. Just the boy, he's a kid going to school, like, you know, in terms of maturing as well, he's a million miles off. I didn't mature until I was about 22, and I'm not sure if I still have matured, Marie. But in terms of that stuff as well, as I say, it just doesn't sit right with me, purely for the fact that what is the rush? What is the mad rush in a young fella playing at 13 going out playing for Glenavon last night? Like is he that much of a difference maker that they need to rely on a 13-year-old? If I was 25 in the dressing room and you're kind of looking, thinking, what's going on here? Like, you know?
It'd be like your little brother, you know, patting on the head, going to mind him, what are you doing here?
And I'm sure they look after him, but maybe keep him training if they think he's that good.
He has been in around the first team. He did say that as well. He was in around the first team last year, which would have made him 12. And they were going to play him in the last game of the season last year. So obviously they're just... I don't know, as you said, just trying to play him. But he was gone away with his dad to watch Celtic.
Plus, if that's the case as well, yeah, well, that's madness if they were going to play him last year. Yeah, well, then, to me, that's just utter madness. And then, is it a case if he's training with the first team, does then he drop down and play with the under-13s at the weekend and all his mates and his friends and all?
And it's funny because, like, it wouldn't happen in GAA. It wouldn't happen in rugby. Like, why does it happen in football, Paul, where you have these really young players making first-team debuts?
Oh, I've no idea, Marie. And if you just think about it, you know, the environment that young kid is in, if you're throwing back even 12 months, a 12-year-old around a man's changing him in the environment and the topic of conversation, like, it's not suitable in any way, shape or form. I can't really grasp any reason why they would do that other than a publicity stunt. Why does it happen in football? I'm not too sure. It doesn't happen to Sydney, Marie, particularly in our own league. You don't see it too often, but yeah, maybe it does tend to happen because the game is maybe less physical. It sounds, Marie, I actually read a tweet earlier that you know, they must be trying to sell him to Chelsea and then loan him out to Vitesse Arnhem for the next 10 years.
But if it's a thing as well, like, as I said, if they want and they rate him that highly or they think he's that good, just train with the first team for another couple of years. Like, you know, as I say, what is the mad rush? Like, it's to me, it's it's utter madness if you ask me, Marie. That's the like 15. I get throwing a young lad in. Wayne Rooney, was he 16 when he played? And I can kind of understand a little bit at that stage. But he's obviously developed physically, and he was a strong boy as well when he was young. I remember seeing him, and there was a lot of talk about him 13, 14, 15, all that. But they still held on till 16. And there comes a point maybe where you can't hold on any longer, but you can certainly hold on at 13.
Yeah. It happens not now, but it's definitely happened a lot in women's sport. So I know Ursula Jacob, I think, was 14 when she made her Wexford debut. Veronica Curtin won an All-Ireland with Galway when she was 15. So, like, it doesn't happen now. But sure, Cora Staunton, the perfect example, I think she was maybe 13 when she played. But that was a different time. And, I mean, 16 now, you'd probably see it all right. But it would be rare enough for sure. Okay, guys, interesting chat. And look, we'll follow this young lad's career anyway and see where he goes from here.
Well, that's the thing. It'll be interesting to follow where he goes from here. But he'll be playing with the under-13s now on Saturday.
I know, imagine he's going out with the 13s. Paul, are you all right there? There's an alarm in the background. We're getting a bit worried about you. No, he's gone.
He's been stolen. Yeah. Paul has been stolen.
Paul, just text us and let us know you're okay. Right, we're going to take a very quick break. Paul and Alan, thank you so much for coming in. We'll keep an eye on this Celtic game as well as the programme goes on. Stay with us. We are going to preview the URC very shortly. RTE 2FM. Hello, Neil. Now, I have to apologise to all the listeners because I spoke into the microphone and I didn't have the microphone on. So, once again, for a second time in 30 seconds, I would like to welcome Neil Tracy to the show. Neil, how are you?
I'm very well, Marie. How are you?
Grand. You're listening to Dead Air. So, Paul Corry's alarm is going off. I forget to turn my microphone on. It's all gone a bit wrong here.
I was wondering, had I disconnected from the line there for
no, that was me.
A couple of seconds.
So, the URC is back, Neil. Should we be excited about it?
We should, 100%, because we got a good game coming up first up on Saturday anyway. Ulster and Connacht is probably the game of the weekend right across the board, and it's rare we get a derby like that first up in the season. And look, I think the main thing as well, Maureen, it's going to carry throughout this entire season as well, is that it's a World Cup mm-hmm. year, and naturally every single thing that happens in this World Cup season just kind of gets viewed through that prism of, like, you know, every young little bolter that comes along, you're talking about, can he break into a World Cup squad next year? Can he, you know, get into the Ireland setup before then? Every province, every win, loss, just everything gets magnified along the way. And then there's people who are coming back from injury. And I think the one to watch, obviously, this weekend and throughout the season is someone like Jacob Stockdale at mm-hmm. Ulster. Someone who this time 4 years ago was arguably in the probably the form winger in the entire world. And if you look at the injury run he had last year, played one game, played the opening game for Ulster last season, picked up an injury, picked up another one, and ended up being ruled out for the entire campaign. And all of a sudden, he's coming back in now, having fallen way down the pecking order when it comes to Ireland. And, you know, just purely from an Ulster point of view, wants to get his foot back in there. And I think he's going to have a great chance. If you look at, I suppose, what we're probably going to talk about in the next few minutes as well, is the emerging Ireland tour, which is actually seeing two of his wing rivals, the back three rivals in the Ulster setup, taken away, and that's opening a window for him all of a sudden.
Yeah, well, I guess, look, the one thing that they all have going for them, the lads that are trying to make it into the World Cup squad, is they have a bit of time now. Like, there is a good chunk of it before decisions are made and squads are announced and all the rest. And you mentioned that development team that are heading off to Bloemfontein to play against three Currie Cup sides. So they're going to have a 3-day camp in the IRFU's High Performance Centre first before heading down to South Africa to play the game. And it's been met not with universal welcome, really. A lot of people have been critical of it, including Bernard Jackman today on the RTE Rugby podcast, saying that he thought it was a terrible idea. What's your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I'd be leaning towards what Bernard Jackman was saying there. I don't see what the real value is of it. Now, I suppose maybe when the squad was announced this afternoon, you can understand the logic of why a lot of those players are going. A lot of that 35-man squad are guys who they're probably not even going to be involved on a regular basis for their provinces anyway. They're still quite young on the professional scale. Guys, or someone like Michael McDonald coming into Ulster, who's coming from Australia and is Irish qualified, and they want to get a look at him. But then guys like Che Mullins or Jamie Osborne, who've been playing under 20s in recent years, and they, you know, they're not crucial to their provinces on a weekly basis, but there are plenty of other people there who are going to be a massive loss to their team. And I mentioned Ulster, they're losing Robert Balakoon, mm-hmm. who is, you know, one of their most crucial players at the moment. And Balakoon, he was involved with Ireland, what, the summer of 2021. He was involved in the Autumn Internationals camp, where he got another camp cap last year. He was involved in the Six Nations. He didn't quite get to actually play in it. He didn't make the cut there. And then he missed out on the New Zealand squad due to injury. But I just would kind of wonder, what are the Irish coaches going to learn about someone like Robert Balakoon in three games against Currie Cup teams that they're not going to learn by seeing Robert Balakoon take on the Scarlets, Leinster and Ospreys for Ulster? That's the question I would probably ask. And then there's other people. I would look at someone like Dylan Tierney-Martin for Connacht, who's just out of 20s, had an awful run last year due to injuries, really, really promising hooker. And I would say with Shane Delahunt coming back from injury, this was a great opportunity for him in the early games of the season with Connacht to just get game time with them, because that's something he hasn't had early on in his career. So there's just a few things like that as well. And then also, you look at Connacht, I mean, they're just being hit really hard by it. I mentioned Dylan Tierney-Martin there, but Cian Prendergast, who has gone from being a young prospect to being one of their most important players. He's going on the tour. He's going to be missing three massive games against the Stormers, Bulls and Munster. And then someone else as well, like Caelan Blade, one of their most experienced players. I know they're still going to have Kieran Marmion, but Blade and Marmion pretty much swapped their minutes around. He was going to be huge in those games. So there's...
Yeah, we seem to have lost Neil there. So I think it's a good time to play Guy Easterby's his reaction to this criticism.
There's been dialogue going on for quite some time about this trip to South Africa. Come down to some individual conversations about individual players. The wider context, I guess, we're trying to build that depth in the squad for us as a national team. To do that, we need time with the players. We need to find out a little bit more about them, about their personalities, about how do they adapt to international rugby, or at least adapt to situations where we've only got three or four training sessions to prepare for a game. We've got three games across a 10-day period. You know, we're only together for 18 days. There's lots of things that we've had to consider within this. One of them has been, you know, how much are we disrupting, you know, the provinces and their needs in the URC. I think we've tried to be as flexible as we can be. And there's always going to be question marks over certain selections because of that. But we also feel like there's been a good dialogue throughout this process. And hopefully we've come to a position where, you know, we've not disrupted things too much. The timing of the tour coincides with a lot of players returning from their national break. So that player management and welfare has been sort of the forefront of a lot of what we've been talking about, and understanding that, yes, we're taking players out of their system, but there'll also be players re-entering their system at the same time as when we travel.
Now, Simon Easterby there talking about his emerging Ireland squad that's heading to South Africa. Neil Tracy is back. Neil, we're almost out of time, but just quickly there, listening to Simon Easterby talking about that squad. Like, he makes a good point as well, just about the importance of the environment. And when the World Cup comes around, if we don't have those players, if we don't have some sort of depth, or, you know, maybe have given them that experience, like, a World Cup is important too, and we haven't done as well as we'd have hoped. Like, maybe this is what they need. No, well, Neil's gone again, so we're having no luck today at all. But conveniently, we are out of time. We'll be back tomorrow, though, and we'll pick up our URC preview. Tara Kumar is up next. RTE 2FM.